Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an addiction conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Addiction, as in the chronic compulsive brain disease for the need of habit-forming substance or behavior. There's alcohol addiction, drug addiction, gambling addiction, sexual addiction, and even sugar addiction. I think I have that one. The disease model of addiction arose in the 1950s to counteract the view that addiction is a moral failing. Way back then, we were able to identify biological changes to the brain of people with addiction. The good news is that the brain changes associated with addiction are not permanent. The brain can recover to normal, and people can recover from addiction. Over the years, the field of addiction medicine has evolved. How far have we come and where do we need to go? To learn more about addiction, I reached out to Dr. Mark Gold. Dr. Mark Gold is a world-renowned expert on addiction-related diseases and worked for 40-plus years developing models for understanding the effects of opioids, tobacco, cocaine, and other drugs, as well as food. Dr. Gold continues his research teaching and consulting as an adjunct professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Washington University in St. Louis. He has prolific publications and authored over 1,000 scientific papers, books, and articles. The number of clicks on his publications makes him a top scientific influencer. He now has weekly articles in Psychology Today. To learn more about Dr. Mark Gold, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Dr. Mark Gold on February 21, 2025. Dr. Mark Gold, welcome to High Truths.
Hey, thanks very much.
I'm very excited. Yeah, I've been looking forward to this conversation, and I saw you in D.C., and I was like, wow, I need to have Mark on the show. So thank you so much for agreeing.
And that was a great ceremony, wasn't it?
It was. It was. We both saw each other at the Cosmos Club in D.C. as a celebration for Dr. Bob DuPont, and you gave him you also did a great speech about him, and it was like a family reunion, but a professional reunion from people across the country who like Bob DuPont and are into the addiction field. So I was honored to be invited, and it was fun to talk to the people all around there.
Well, it was great to meet you there, and it's funny that, the people that Bob knows, and I looked around the room, there were directors of NIDA, and there were people that he knew in the White House, and most people don't have any idea about the breadth of his career. So I just really wanted, they're young people from that don't know in the day. He was a card-carrying Democrat setting up a altruistic methadone program in Washington, D.C. And he went to work for Richard Nixon. And really, his work helped us prove that methadone was safe and effective. And then he became really the founding director of NIDA. There was Kentucky and other things in the back, but he was really the one that helped everyone understand that NIDA could really serve the country by helping to develop an evidence base around addiction. And he also was a drug czar, and then he owned all the IBH things. And honestly, it was just a great honor for me to be able to do it, and I was grateful that they asked me, and I missed you know, I mean, I missed a couple of things in his life, but I did get to interview him one other time. And anyways, just he's a fantastic.
He is. And he's been on this show. He's been on this podcast, High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, a couple times.
That's great.
Yeah. All right. So your background, you're a nice Jewish boy from Teaneck, New Jersey. And I guess your parents gave you two choices. You could be a doctor or a lawyer.
Well, I mean, I don't know that I could be characterized that simplistically, but it is true that my brother's a lawyer. I really started out like thinking that I would be a basic scientist only. And in my career, for the most part, if you went back and said, what did you teach for 40 plus years? It was medical neuroscience. I taught neuroanatomy. And then as a researcher, I was a translational neuroscientist, meaning that I would do studies in rats or non-human primates, and then hope to graduate to people, which was the way we did research in the 1970s before computers and modeling and AI and so forth. So I'd say I was inspired by Levi Montalcini, a basic scientist who invented really nerve growth factor and won a Nobel Prize for her work at Washington University in St. Louis. And I even did some work in nerve growth factor myself as it related to drugs. And from WashU, I went to the University of Florida, where I was able to teach medical neuroscience, neuroanatomy, at the same time as I went to medical school, which was a great boost to my career, and where I started doing brain systems involved in opioids, the so-called nucleus locus coeruleus and noradrenergic systems. I did that work at University of Florida. I did sleep and memory at the University of Florida. I did state dependency of drugs of abuse and effects at University of Florida. And then there I was only working with mice and rats. And so I graduated to non-human primates and went to Yale. And I was at Yale from 75 and continued in the faculty till about early 80s. And my work there was translated beyond just the lab. And I got to start doing work in the emergency room and start doing work in addiction psychiatry with Herb Kleber and Bob Bick.
Wow. And you saw patients too.
Clinical. Yeah. In the emergency room, I probably gave naloxone in early in 75. I learned that sometimes when you saved a person's life, they weren't grateful, which was a shock to me. I learned that if you gave naloxone, it was very short acting. And if a person had overdosed on a longer acting drug, they would end up
dead. Methadone.
And they went outside in the parking lot. I learned, yes, exactly. So, you know, we learned things. At that time, it's hard to even imagine this. It's so arcane, but there were no addiction medicine fellowships, so I couldn't specialize in it. I had to moonlight by going to Kleber's clinics, which were all storefront clinics outside of Yale and outside of Yale New Haven Hospital. And that's how I learned. So he had me run the methadone programs, see all the clients, work on experimental programs, which he had early comparing methadone to naltrexone. That's all in 75. And then I kind of got the chance to develop a model system for how we understand opioid action and opioid withdrawal from rats to non-human primates. And that's really how we came up with the idea of trying clonidine or lofexidine in opioid withdrawal, reversing it And we had the first non-addicting treatment for opioid withdrawal, which ironically, things were so primitive back then that the drug company that made it was afraid that we had created a monster, because at that time, an opioid was defined as anything that reversed opioid withdrawal.
Okay. Well, I guess it does.
Yeah, exactly. But of course, it wasn't an opioid. So yeah. They never really tried to get clonidine approved for opioid withdrawal treatment, fearing that it would be a detriment in some way or another, or complicate in some way or another the use of the medicine in other parts for hypertension and so on. But it is a very interesting time. If we got a patient in the emergency room, I would see them and I'd say, well, where could this person with alcohol use disorder go? And they would go anywhere other than the hospital. And I go, well, they need to go in the hospital. And they go like, well, we don't do that here. You couldn't admit a patient with a substance use disorder to psychiatry, to medicine, unless they were...
unless they had some other medical complication, then you could.
Exactly. Yeah. They had to have something. And it was like, so it was, everything was church basement. So that's how I learned about AA. That's how I learned to go to meetings. It was Daytop Village or long-term residential treatment. I learned about that.
That's pretty incredible, because even today, rarely do you see psychiatrists in the emergency department helping in that kind of way. They help with mental health admissions now, because we have so many mental health patients in the emergency department. They, you know, we call them for an admission or a consult, but not for, you know, severe alcohol use disorder or overdose. That's interesting. Well,
there was nobody else to do it. Certainly no one in internal medicine. I remember at Mount Sinai, we had Stan Gitlow, who was in internal medicine, and he would take care of people with alcohol use disorders. In Atlanta, we had Doug Talbot, who was another Yale guy, and he would take care of physicians, but he was trained as a urologist. Or Conway Hunter, who started his own treatment programs, who's trained in OB. But for the most part, the people who were in Kentucky were the original NIDA, were psychiatrists. Or at Harlem Hospital, my colleague and collaborator, Benny Prim, was a psychiatrist. So I'd say in the old days, psychiatrists would always do their own physical exams, would do their own neurological exams, especially the psychiatrists that worked in an inpatient service or in crisis service or in the emergency rooms. And that was, I didn't feel that was special at Yale. Maybe the special thing that I did there was to take everybody's drug patients because they were so willing to give them up.
Oh, yeah. It's like, yeah, you can have this.
Yeah. Really, if you have all these patients, wouldn't you rather have a patient that appreciated you or that thanked you for saving their life? And also in addiction, we're often telling people that they have a disease that is very, very serious and might. If I went back, some of my friends at Yale were oncologists, and we kind of were like-minded in the way of saying that this is a terrible disease. It's chronic, relapsing, and lifelong, and you need continuous treatment. And I think that's a part that, when you said to me, like, some of the things that I wrote or things we're talking about for 10 years, I was saying, well, you know, it's not just 10 years.
Yeah, it's longer than that.
Yeah, I mean, because we don't have cures. We have treatments. We don't even have an agreement as to what is a successful outcome across the board. Psychiatrists might feel differently about outcome than addiction medicine doctors. But net, the major things in the field are pretty much the same. I mean, the newest treatment, I did a review of the alcohol use disorder treatments, and the newest treatment is 20 years old. The most effective treatments are older. For opioid use disorders, I can't remember when I first wrote about buprenorphine, but I'm sure it's 25 years ago. And methadone is, of course, way before that. Antabuse is before methadone. For tobacco, we have nicotine replacement. Varenicline is maybe newer, but again, it's probably in the 20-year range. We need new treatments, and we could certainly use a cure.
You know, your analogy with cancer is really interesting. Like this, this is a serious lifelong disease, and people say, "I beat cancer," but you always have to be tracked. It can always come back. Once you have it, it's a lifetime of monitoring. And even if you have addiction, you're in recovery. You always have to pay attention to it, right?
Well, I mean, in AA, they always talk about the transition, like when is the switch from use or user to addict, or how does a cucumber become a pickle? And that's pretty much how people in AA have thought about it. And no one has a date. They can't tell you the date it happened. It's sneaky. It sneaks up on them. But then once they change and they have a substance use disorder, it's quite different. That's why many people in our field have said we have to look to diabetes. We need pre-addiction. We need to identify people before they turned into a pickle, because we've never been able to figure out how to turn them back to a cucumber. So if that's just the case, we need to be more honest with people about the limitations of treatment. And I've been, have been on all kinds of prevention committees and prevention boards with Sue Thaw and CADCA. I was on the board, and I've been on the board of Addiction Policy Forum, and I've been on the board of DARE. I've been on the board of the DEA Educational Foundation. The reason for that, all these voluntary board services, is that the only 100% safe and effective treatment is prevention. The rest of it is like taking insulin the rest of your life.
Yeah. The analogy I give to people is everything's a continuum, right? There's people who have diabetes, and they may have a mild case and they could lose weight and be okay. And some people need to be on an insulin pump their whole life, and in between.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's complicated with addiction in part because some of the psychiatry diagnostic schemes that have been adopted by addiction medicine may not hold out.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, this is just a thought in my mind. I shouldn't but I'll just put it out there. All addictions, all drugs of abuse cause dopamine release. That's obvious. Yeah. And they all do it in quite a different way. I mean, opioids have a dopamine increasing effect through initial interaction with the opioid receptor, where cocaine has its effect directly through the end game, the dopamine system. But so if you say that there's a common neuroanatomy for all drugs of abuse, which of course I wrote in 1984, and that's how I met Nora, and she made my dopamine hypothesis famous by proving it in the human PET imaging. I mean, the moral of the story, if that's a common neuroanatomy, and then you bring Eric Nestler's work in, and that interfering with this dopamine system, drugs interfere with it, and then they reprioritize the brain's organizational structure so that food, water, and sex move down and drugs move up ahead of it. I mean, so survival moves down and drugs move up, so that in a way, drugs are a parasite that kills the host. So it's a really kind of interesting question. So if that's all true, then there's probably only one addiction diagnosis, substance use disorder. So we then focus it like on opioid use disorder. Well, I mean, really, is that different than a substance use disorder? Even if you look at postmortems, even if you look at people who overdose, the overwhelming majority of people who overdose have more than one drug in their body at the time of overdose. Yeah. People use drugs because they're out there. We live in a drug supermarket. So in the overdoses, even for opioids, they actually stopped counting cannabis in overdoses because there were too many people on cannabis at the time of their overdose. So it's, right. To me, it's likely to think that there's one addiction, and which drug it is doesn't, it's maybe related to, we don't know what it's related to, but I think that's...
Supply is one thing, right?
The what?
Supply. It's related.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't have heroin, you're not going to be addicted to heroin, right? You're going to move on to fentanyl.
Yeah. I agree. And, you know, there's genetic work and there's risk work about trauma. I agree to all that. There's, we'll see what happens. But as of right now, it hasn't been the most useful strategy to have 20 different diagnoses based on the 20 different drugs that are out there, because right now we don't have, except for opioids, where we do have a treatment, we don't have one for cocaine overdose or cocaine craving or cocaine relapse or cocaine use disorder. We don't have one for amphetamine overdose, amphetamine craving, amphetamine use disorder, or relapse prevention. We don't have one for cannabis. And with all these dimensions, we do have a treatment for opioids. And it's interesting, here we have the best treatment for opioids, and the most people are dying.
Right. Well, there's a reason for that, right? And that's probably two reasons. One is the lethality of fentanyl, just because it's so lethal that, you know, like the one pill can kill. And that's what skyrocketed the potency and lethality of fentanyl compared to the other drugs. And the other thing is that we haven't really measured enough is some people die of fentanyl, but they don't have an opiate use disorder. They just made a mistake.
Yeah. Well, yes, I agree to all of that. The opioid crisis is just evolved like the rest of our drug crises. And the next crisis will likely be a recognition that polysubstance use is the main problem. The idea that, I go back to my 70s. In the 70s, we had an opioid epidemic. We had opioids coming from Southeast Asia. But we did not have an opioid death epidemic, in part because of what you said, the difference between heroin and fentanyl. But there was even a difference between heroin and OxyContin. So I do think that that's interesting, but it's part of the same theme. Like look at it, when Woodstock 1, we had 0.5% THC marijuana. That would be in a museum now. I mean, it's a joke. Yeah. Like, you know, so you have 20 times that, and that's considered weak. So everything has been Americanized, meaning higher dose and changing the route. So yes, we did have cocaine and Coca-Cola, and yes, people did have cocaine tea, and yes, people did have cocaine plus wine, but we invented crack in America. Yeah. And I just think So for opioids, when you do change the dose, you do have this toxicity. And our approach to that has been, rightly so, to say that we should reverse all the overdoses with naloxone, and that's important. However, it's likely that there's a residual effect on the brain of just having an overdose. So we need to prevent overdoses. Like you said, one pill can kill, rather than think that we're reversing it. If you think about people...
Naloxone saves the person's life, but it doesn't cure their addiction.
But it's even worse than that, because there's no evidence that it reversed the brain injury caused by the drug anoxia.
Yeah. And well, I mean, as an emergency physician, it's like a time thing, right? It depends how long you've had no oxygen to your brain.
Right. So you have the common, so you have that. Then there'll be other risk factors. Like, so if you look at it like drowning or you got hit by lightning, I don't know what, pick an example. You're an emergency physician. But when I look at it, I know that the most oxygen sensitive cells in the brain are in the hippocampus, which sadly is what you need to make new memories and to function in the modern world. One study that the University of Florida did that I found really interesting was they took doctors who developed a substance use disorder and tested them with a series of neuropsychological tests. And they found a lot of things that were very peculiar. It's been reported in the literature. And I did reference it in one of my Psychology Today articles, which was about the damage caused. But doctors are a good example because they tend to have good diets. They tend to have late onset addictions. And if even they have neuropsychological test decrements that can be demonstrated easily in fitness for duty testing after they're treated, I bet everybody has them who's had an overdose. And by the way, when you look at your charts as an emergency doctor, you can't even find out how many times the person's overdosed. You can't find out how many times they've been reversed. None of that data is available to you, and nobody is going to be doing...
I just asked the patient, how many times has this happened? And I am shocked, and I'm shocked. 9 times, you know, 10 times, somebody 27 times. Like, wow, you have more lives than a cat.
Well, because I agree. If you're selling drugs, there's a fine line between having the most potent and reinforcing drugs and killing people. So they're always playing with this. And we've even learned that some of the fentanyl labs actually test the dose on people before they send it
test
to the
people.
United States.
I've met patients who are like, they were the tester. They were like very proud. This guy was saying he is he gets all his drugs for free because he's the lab rat.
Well, I mean, I think people just don't understand that there's no way to really know. Now, it's not perfect, of course, because everybody has their own tolerance. But I do think that's a missing piece here, is that overdose is serious. We can reverse overdose from the breathing and cardiovascular point of view. But the idea that we reversed it in the hippocampus, the effects of anoxic, I don't think that's been proven to my satisfaction as a researcher at all.
Yeah, it depends for how long. So you bring an incredible historical perspective to the field of addiction. Let me ask you, like bench, and you also have the bench research aspect and the clinical and practical aspect. So taking the bench research in your career, how far have we come along? Have we come a long way, baby, or there's still too much that we don't know, or both?
Certain things have come along a long way. So when the American Society of Addiction Medicine started its textbook. I think I wrote 7 or 8 of the chapters.
You're amazing.
No, and I mean, there's so few people in the field. Like, there were 15 people. I invited Nora the first time she was ever invited.
And then just to make sure, we've mentioned Nora several times. Nora Wolkoff, the director of of NIDA. And she's been on this show every year.
Yeah, or Gene Jack Wang. Or I invited him because I was on the program committee for ASAM. There was like 10 people. I mean, it's like hardly anyone contributing. So I think on the evidence base, if you look at the NIDA, the ASAM textbook now, I only write one chapter. Now, of course, I'm old, but keep in mind, there's so many experts. I was the founding editor of the addiction section and ran the addiction section of UpToDate, the textbook of medicine from Harvard, for 10 years. Now, there are plenty of people who could take over. In fact, that was easy transition for me. So, I mean, one thing that's changed is the number of experts. And if you look at addiction medicine, like you pointed out, there are probably 6,000 board-certified addiction medicine physicians.
I'm one of them.
That's a, mazel tov. I mean, and in fact, that's a great thing. And that was a thing that we helped start. You're not one of these, but I worked on the Board of Medicine and helped recovering doctors get their license back, do training in addiction medicine. And I helped 80 of these doctors in my career in Florida do that. And that were they all had both the formal fellowship with us and then the lived experience. And you add the two together and they were great. All the original medical directors at Betty Ford were recovering doctors. And in our Florida Recovery Center, we have a recovering pediatrician who's the director. And anyway, so we made a lot of progress on the science experts, and we made a lot of progress on the clinical experts and treatment physicians. The translational treatments, we've made some progress. We've tried, but it's really hard to invent a new treatment. And it takes a long time.
How about knowledge of the brain, the chemistry, and understanding addiction?
If I look back at my papers in 75, there is significant improvement. I had in my addiction outlook year end for Psychology Today, I listed Eric Nestler's paper as better than everyone's in talking about knowledge of the brain and where drugs of abuse do the hijacking. But the fact that we said in 78, drugs like opioids hijacked the brain, the fact that by 84 we had a dopamine hypothesis, I think it's grandiose to think we've made very much more progress. We haven't made useful progress for the poor suffering addicts, for their families. We can't predict who's at the greatest risks of addiction. We've made progress, and I do think by talking about hijacking and talking about the brain like you do, we do destigmatize addiction and we help people find treatment and hope and help.
I kind of also think we went too far with the stigma thing because we don't want stigma for the human being who has a disease, but we do want stigma on the drug. We don't want our children to use drugs.
Well, that's a really good point. People who study the history would be, they'd jump up and say, without stigmatizing cigarettes, we wouldn't have made any progress.
Right. That's my point. You know, right? It's like kissing an ashtray. Who wants to do that?
Well, that was Brooke Shields. That was her famous commercial.
That was important.
Yeah, I did, but she did stigmatize the user. She said, "I didn't realize you were a loser." I mean, but I do think and so did I answer that question? I think I did.
Yeah.
I said
so
we made progress, but it's not.
We made a lot of progress. You're saying in the 70s, 80s, as far as the biochemistry of addiction, but we haven't done a lot more in the recent years. The number of people who are in the addiction field has skyrocketed. And clinically, okay, and then, so let me ask you, where do we need to go?
Well, it's also, and we've created like silos. So you have people who, and for no reason, they're like different sides of this, but it doesn't make any sense to me at all. So like, you could be a person that believes in medication-assisted treatments, and who wouldn't? There's evidence for medication-assisted treatments, but that has nothing to do with whether we should have rehabs, in my opinion. Because if you're running a buprenorphine program, what do you do with someone who's using buprenorphine and methamphetamine? What do you do with someone who's an opioid user and has two or three other addictions and also has psychiatric problems? Like, there's a great study that everybody forgets about, really. But if you look at people, they did it at McLean Hospital, Harvard's teaching hospital, and you look at people who were rescued from an opioid overdose, a high percent of them wish they had just died. Or is a number that a smaller number that were overdosed as a mechanism of suicide, but a larger number of them said, you know, I wouldn't have really minded, and it would have been easier on my family if I would have just died. And I just think it's more complicated than giving people Suboxone, or I'd be able to do that in a pharmacy. I wouldn't need a doctor visit.
I had a patient one time, actually, who had an addiction to methamphetamine and recovered. And he was saying after he was off methamphetamine, so he was done with that, that's when he was depressed and suicidal. And I really realized that, okay, we got rid of the drug, but we didn't get rid of the hole in his heart.
So, you know, I mean, methamphetamine, we could do a whole show on methamphetamine, but Jean-Luc Cadet, who's at NIDA, and I had a cover of Biological Psychiatry once about methamphetamine and how a binge on methamphetamine has similar neurotoxic effects as a concussion in football. But we don't have brain healing effects for drugs like this. But methamphetamine's effect on the many, by the way, almost even if you were taking opioids or post-fentanyl, my group showed post-fentanyl anhedonia and depression was very, very common. So if drugs of abuse target the brain's pleasure system and cause craving and wanting, but they do cause euphoria, in the absence of them, the brain has to reset, or else you do have dysphoria. But for the most potent drug, like you mentioned, fentanyl, for the opioid system, you'd get anhedonia, meaning the absence or inability to experience pleasure from normal everyday life. That, to me, is a big cause of repeat drug use, relapse, overdose, suicide.
What is the reason for that anhedonia? Is that the
it's toxic. Parts,
it's part of the brain that died now that you can't...
It's basically, so if drugs target the nucleus accumbens, well, why should they take it forever? How do they take it? Like, it's not, they're not supposed to be there in that amount. So you just have there's a certain amount of neurotoxicity that accompanies substance use with higher doses and more chronicity that can undermine the whole pleasure system's function.
No.
And that's right, why some people have called, by the way, for the use of brain stimulation, the whole group of West Virginia, the use of TMS, some use of neuromodulatory treatments that might improve the brain, rather than just hoping that through abstinence diet and that it'll be better. And other researchers, Pete Thanos, Nora's old collaborator, has said, if you think about how to make the brain return to normal, and hardly anyone does, you're only stuck with abstinence, diet, exercise, and neuromodulation right now. We don't have a treatment for it, physical treatment.
Wow. So where do we need to go in this field?
People have looked at psychedelics because you do have a chance with psychedelics to return the brain, like rebooting a computer to a place before, in other words, to that cucumber state.
So that's can I just wait a second?
Yeah.
That has to come with a caveat, because if I've heard Nora say that, and now you're saying that, and yet, you know, the last date I saw of kids who died by suicide, and now we're seeing psilocybin there, and now we're seeing the commercialization, and we need psychedelics, and I need this as my medicine. So I think before anybody says, hey, there's hope in X, we have to not forget the dangers, right?
I've never said anyone should use anything that isn't approved by the FDA.
Yeah, but I think that has to come along. Like, this is an important area of research that warrants FDA approval, and not for the proliferation commercialization of Amazon sales of magic mushrooms.
No, I was being more serious than that. Like, even in the face of obvious use disorders and even death, ketamine's approved for the use in major depression as a nasal spray in the S enantiomer form. And there's no problem that I know of with Johnson & Johnson's nasal spray ketamine for depression. And right. I'll tell you what the good news is. If you, God forbid, were depressed, you would have to be given an antidepressant, wait about 6 weeks to tell if it worked. Then if it didn't work, we'd raise the dose or switch the antidepressant. People have shown quite clearly that if you fail on one antidepressant, you're 2 to 4 times more likely to succeed on Spravato, the inhalable ketamine, than a second antidepressant. We've shown, like, if you're a psychiatrist in an emergency room, people want to die sometimes, and they come in acutely suicidal. Well, we used to have to tie them down in 4-point restraints and physically, like, restrain them, and or chemically restrain them, or send them to a locked psychiatric unit, or in a padded cell. I remember padded cells, for God's sake. Well, now you could give somebody ketamine, and that might be an answer. So I do think the nuance here is on your side, which is my side too. I'm the one that wrote the article on whether there's use of cannabis in psychiatry. And the answer is, of course, no. But there are going to be drugs of abuse that have a use in medicine. And I do think ketamine is a very good example, because not giving people IV ketamine, not allowing people to inject themselves randomly, Matthew Perry style, but following the REMS FDA guidance on inhaled S-ketamine, now called Spravato, we have a safe new treatment that, by the way, works almost within the first day or two rather than 6 to 12 weeks.
Yeah, and maybe now that you're here, it's the same thing with opioids. Opioids are very good medications, right? But they're not meant for you to take on your own and be your own doctor. And maybe that's kind of the problem that we have today in our American society, is there is a lack of trust in government, lack of trust in the medical community, and people are playing their own doctors.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say that's a... I don't have anything to disagree with about that. I was really proud. It was my old lab at Yale that had the basic science on ketamine, and I was really glad to see how they progressed, because if you look at that as an example of what could and should happen and say, well, by the way, that didn't happen for cannabis. Like, has all these uses, where are they?
Yeah.
Like, okay, show me one approval. The approvals, even for the two rare pediatric epilepsies, are really not the kind of thing that we've heard. So I was just answering your question literally, which is, what do we need? We need to think about new treatments. That's A. And I used one example. We need to think about returning the brain to the state that it was before addiction. And that we need to be thinking about how to evaluate and treat all comorbidities so the person doesn't relapse at the same time. And we need to develop rehabilitation, which isn't us versus them, MATs versus rehab, but realizes that there's no medicine that's going to cure a person who, even a physician, when we look at physician addicts, by the way, Bob, remind me of Bob DuPont's work, they're looking at like 5 years of treatment to get their 80% return to work, return to family, abstinence outcome. They're not looking at 5 minutes. Treatment has been turned into a game of, a dangerous game of name that tune. And I can treat this person in with this medicine. And
right. I always say that. It's like, I always ask patients, when did you start using drugs? Yeah. Usually it'll be like 20 years old and it'll be, I started with meth. I said, no, what's the first drug that you used? And then they say, oh, weed. Well, that's just weed. And I was like 10 years old. But the point of that conversation is for the patient to understand that, wait, your brain has been on drugs for 20 years. You're not going to get better in a week.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, even 4 years of drugs isn't this. Herb Cleaver used to say this at Yale. 4 years of drug use is not like going to Yale College. At the end of the 4 years, you've had a lot of time for bad learning, for learning that can compromise and undermine your survival. That's not the same thing about going to college.
Right. And then that's interesting. That's a good perspective. I want to ask you about the latest trends or hopes in addiction. You mentioned ketamine for depression, but what about the Ozempic, the GLP-1 agonists for the treatment of addiction?
So that's a very good one. So, I mean, you may know this, but my work with colleagues at Princeton on sugar self-administration led to the Yale Historic Conference on Food and Addiction. And our notion was that food and addiction were really the same parts of, there are two diseases, but they're similar in neuroanatomy. In other words, food's on, drugs off. So one thing you can do in animals, by the way, even for cocaine, if you overfeed an animal, cocaine self-administration goes down. So there's a relationship, like if you're on a drug and you're addicted and you detox, eating goes up. So we tried to find like treatments for drug abuse that could be treatments for obesity. And so like phentermine plus naltrexone are two treatments that would be used for obesity, and they're used in drugs in treatment of addiction. So finding a common treatment makes a lot of sense to me. And it goes back to the days of my first edition of the Oxford textbook on food and addiction. Ozempic is the newest example of this, but we have other treatments. Again, we have bupropion plus naltrexone for obesity, and bupropion's used for cigarette smoking. Naltrexone's used for opioid addiction and alcohol addiction. And that's, so you have these overlapping treatments. So neurobiologically, this makes sense. The challenge is, let's say Ozempic decreases alcohol drinking. And let's say it decreases cigarette smoking. Both of those, I think, are where the strongest data is right now. Would it be better than naltrexone in decreasing alcohol drinking? Because if you put naltrexone in the water, it decreases alcohol drinking. Ozempic decreases alcohol drinking. Is it better than that? And I might say, yeah, it's better than that. And one of my articles in Psychology Today was about this. Why don't people prescribe naltrexone? Because people don't want to take it. On the other hand, people might take Ozempic because they want to lose weight. So just the idea that it might have better adherence might make it a better treatment. But I don't have any evidence that either that Ozempic or any of the GLP-1s are going to promote abstinence and recovery. There'll be harm reduction approaches at the max, and there won't be any benefit once you stop. In other words, yeah, I mean, like, you could take Ozempic and it would decrease your drinking. You could take naltrexone and it will decrease your drinking. But without addiction treatment, the day you stop, your risks are greater than they would have been.
That's counter to the thought that medication alone can help or worthwhile.
Yeah, no, it isn't. Because, like, even in the buprenorphine data, if you take buprenorphine for opioid use disorder, the day you stop, your risk of overdose starts to increase, and it ends up quickly being the same as before you started.
Without the behavioral health component?
Yeah. Without even with the, it's a Columbia study I can share with you, but without an intense treatment component like proposed by Bob DuPont for impaired health professionals.
Yeah. Interesting. One of the, I remember being at one of your lectures, and you're very proud to be like this, I think, like this science influencer. Like, if you were like on Instagram, or you'd get so many like likes or tweets, but you got that for all your articles. And I think you said that you're like the, you know, some of your publications are the top number clicks or views or something.
Sometimes I'll write one of these pieces and it gets picked up by Google News. And you go like, how does that happen? I have no idea. It's magic.
I think the number of clicks. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I have no idea how that happens. And my daughter, Jessica, I have two daughters, is a sincere psychiatry influencer. And I'm the accidental tourist here. So, like, I'll write something and all of a sudden, like, it's on, somebody will say, you know, you had like 10,000 people like reading your article. And I go like, really? So just the thing that amazes me about this is, like, I could write a science article and make a citation classic, like an academic classic. And I think you only need 200 citations for that. But one of my like Psychology Today articles was read by like 20,000 people. It's just not even comparable.
Yeah. Well, I looked at your articles. Each one is a jewel. Each one of them is a jewel. Like, I'm like, okay, I gotta follow. I have to figure out how to do that. Each of these articles. I'll just read for our audience some of the examples, because I think everybody should look at your columns in Psychology Today. 5 common false beliefs of abusive drug use users and addiction. call to reassess cannabis risk, detoxing from dopamine, medical, quote, quote, medical marijuana and chronic pain. Thank you for adding those quotes and calling to reassess cannabis risk. So I think they are amazing. Do you have a favorite?
Hey, you know, that's a funny thing. I don't have a favorite child either.
That's a good one. Good answer. Spoken like a good psychologist, trained by his mom. That's very nice.
Thank you.
All right. So, the most recent one that you wrote, I hope you get a lot of clicks on it, is reassessing the risk of cannabis. And I feel like we've been saying this for many years, but somehow this got a lot of attention.
It did get a lot of attention. I'll tell you, it had, like, just in the last couple of days since it was up there, it's had about 3,500 people reading it. Not as much as you would think, because it's, again, kind of bad news. Like,
Yeah, and most of those clicks are probably from the industry to debunk your statement.
So the American Psychiatric Association asked me and Kevin Hill, the head of addiction at Harvard's Beth Israel Hospital, to do a review on the risks and benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids. And so we presented to the Council, American Council of Psychiatry, a very long paper. And then they summarized in the American Journal of Psychiatry. So we had a lot of understanding of the field. And again, as you heard from me, I kind of like this process, the FDA trials, because it involves placebo, you know, like you point out for MDMA. When they did looked at the placebo, they said it wasn't a good enough trial, and they didn't approve it, the FDA, for MDMA. But for ketamine, there was a good enough control. And for marijuana, there's really nothing. But the only big trend out there is the amount of THC per dose is increasing. The number of cannabis use disorders in the United States is increasing. It's one of the fastest growing addictions in the United States. And here, cannabis use disorders, we don't have a treatment. Like, what's the treatment for cannabis? People say there's no such thing as a cannabis overdose, but people are going to emergency
rooms. I see them every day, right? I don't call it overdose, because people think overdose, you're about to die. I call it poisoning. And every day we see cannabis poisoning.
Exactly. Well, I think that's very important. People don't realize that. People don't realize that a cannabis use disorder is a substance use disorder that's likely to involve bad brain learning and involve nucleus accumbens dopamine training that make you more susceptible to other addictions, especially during if there's teenage use. So there's cannabis poisoning, like you said, cannabis use disorders, like you said. There's clear evidence that cannabis interferes with working memory, new learning. Well, I mean, it's mostly used by young people and they have to learn, so that's a problem. And then there's new data that says if you develop a cannabis use disorder, for one reason or another, you're less likely to survive. That's a new study in JAMA
that was amazing. Like, you can die, because people say, "Oh, you're never going to die from marijuana." It's like,
you don't.
People
you
say, "Well, you're not going to." Right.
Yeah, it's still you still have the chance of an accident or a fall or depression. Like, people use cannabis for depression, but it ends up in young people, it makes depression worse. So if it's, and then there's a whole bunch of new data that I summarized on even suicide, cannabis and suicide. So I don't know.
We have that data from California. The number one drug found in people who died by suicide I asked for age under 25, the developing age, by far more than alcohol is THC.
So that's kind of how I do these. The reason that you like my articles is that I'm very serious. So I like have 8 to 10 references at the end of things you can go to and read. I don't make it up. There's some of my point of view. And I'd say, like, when I was in my 20s, I could invent a new treatment in addiction, which I did and could. But now in my far 70s, I can't do that. But I have pattern recognition that I'm happy to share. And that's principally what I'm doing here, is putting together the new research with pattern recognition and lived experience as an addiction researcher and clinician in addiction psychiatry.
That's amazing. People should follow your articles. So you mentioned treatment protocols. By the way, Mark, I could talk to you all day, but I'm going to let you go. But you started the whole, you know, opiate use disorder treatment, right? And you developed protocols. Yeah. I remember many years ago, I probably copied your protocols, but because I was searching for something to give the medical community as, well, how to say no nicely to opiates and how my protocols were how to prevent people getting started on opiates in the first place. What are alternatives? Let me ask you now, a big gap I feel that we have is we do have a lot of cannabis use disorder that's unrecognized. Every single person with cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, by definition, has a cannabis use disorder. Some of them need to be admitted in the hospital. They're miserable. We try to avoid. The treatment is what we try not to do, try not to give them opiates, use antipsychotics instead. And people are asking, well, is there comfort meds like we did for opiate withdrawal? Is there something we could do to make people feel better, to help with withdrawal? And the latest thing someone told me that they said for the really severe cases is using Epidiolex, which is like CBD.
There's no data for that.
Okay.
I mean, the main treatment should be like, don't use cannabis.
Right, which I explained to people. When I say don't use, people blow me off. When I say that and explain, and it's hard because you are addicted and you will have withdrawal, and these are the symptoms, anxiety, headache, sleep problems. The instinct for physicians is like, but they want a medicine. Like, I need to give you a sleep aid. I need to give you a this or that. And that comes to your other article about, like, detoxing from dopamine, right?
Yeah. Like, doctors, this is one of the things that when you asked me about my career, when we go into addiction, at least in the old days, we had a point of view like an oncologist. And it was not our job to tell the person to take apricot pits for their cancer. It was my job to say, you have an addiction. You need treatment. I can send you to this rehab for an evaluation. You can decide if you stay for treatment after that. I can send you to this residential treatment center or this expert here. But no, I'm not going to enable a use disorder in any way.
So what is it should we do for cannabis hyperemesis syndrome and people with cannabis use disorder that's severe?
Yeah, I'd agree. We don't have a treatment for cannabis overdose. We don't have a treatment for cannabis use disorder. We don't have a treatment for cocaine overdose. We don't have a treatment for cocaine use disorder or methamphetamine overdose or methamphetamine use disorder. But one thing that I do know is they don't occur in isolation and that they tend to be complicated. And if a person was a health professional, we would give them a comprehensive multidisciplinary evaluation at the least and see what else is going on, see what we can evaluate and fix, rather than trivialize it and say, just don't worry about it, or here's some Phenergan.
Yeah, I think you have an important point there. for people with cannabis use disorder and cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, we should, I say, give your body a cleanse, because people are into cleanses these days. I give you, which is the same thing as detoxing from dopamine. But exactly. What I haven't done, which you point out, is like, this is a serious problem and you should have addiction treatment. And I think it's also because the availability of that treatment is lacking.
Yeah, no, I agree. So I mean, I've seen some patients with severe cannabis use disorders who've gone to treatment. It tends to look like the old school alcohol use disorder treatments. The challenge is it's not generally covered by their insurance. So it's the same thing that we have with behavioral addiction. Somebody can have debilitating gambling disorder. We have no reimbursement. And we're in a situation like this where people aren't taking cannabis use disorders seriously, but that this, by the same token, they're not taking cocaine or methamphetamine use disorders seriously. They're treating the opioid use disorder because it is covered, and it is kind of, there's simple algorithms for that, and ignoring the other problems and then wondering why almost everyone is relapsing.
Yeah, that's important. Well, we had a very enlightening conversation. Is there anything else you want to like conclude with?
I'm really proud of you and this work and doing the podcast. And I hope you get the word out, because you have a great, I love working in the Yale emergency room, and I did it for 6 months. I learned addiction from the emergency room up, and that's where the rubber meets the road. So thanks for all your work saving people.
Thank you, Dr. Gold. Thank you for all your years in this field, helping people, you know, in patients and physicians and researchers. And you're a young man, so you have many more years of health.
From your mouth to God's ears.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit DFAF.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.